Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jamie Ford's first novel, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, was a surprise New York Times bestseller. His second book, Songs of a Willow Frost, is the story of a Chinese-American orphan in Seattle during the Great Depression. The book reflects some of Ford's own family history. He joins us on this week's book show to talk about the novel, his fascination with Seattle, his passion for jazz, and buried secrets in families that sometimes come to the surface. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jamie Ford to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this particular place and time, Seattle during the Depression?
You know, I was actually researching Seattle during the Depression before I wrote Hotel. And so I circled back after Hotel was done and went back to that time period. And that was because that was when my grandparents met at a backroom gambling parlor, my Chinese grandparents. My grandfather was a blackjack dealer and a croupier, and my grandmother was the Kochak girl. There was something about that time period, which is an interesting confluence of economic calamity and cultures and ethnicity. There's so much going on.
So when you say you're researching, how much of it is researching history and how much of it is researching your own history?
It's a little indulgent because I like going back to a certain point of time that represents a time period for my father or my grandparents or something like that. But there's so much else going on. There's so much other historical context. The family history becomes an entry point, but from there I really splash around and try to look at the whole landscape.
And the landscape that you wanted to look at in this book, how much of that was predicated by the landscape that you looked at in the first novel?
You know, it's interesting. With Hotel, that I really set out to write a very simple love story, and it caught hold, and it became this larger narrative. And with Songs of Willow Frost, I was always intrigued by Chinatowns during that time period because it's during Prohibition, and there's just so much going on. It's after the war, and there's a flu epidemic, and it was just a juicy time period to splash around in. And when I went there, the more I explored, the more I researched, the more I realized I didn't know or have a clear understanding of what was going on. And so the story really unfolded from there. So I looked at a time and a place, and much to my surprise, there was this also concurrently going on. It was this fledgling film industry, the silent film era. Before the major studios had all coalesced in Southern California, there were studios popping up everywhere in Chicago and Wisconsin and Sandpoint, Idaho, and even Tacoma, Washington, where the long-lost H.C. Weaver studios existed for a short time.
Talk about those studios and about that part of the novel in just a moment. I'm curious.
Sure.
As to what brought you to, we talked a little bit about the history, but was there something that compelled you to write this particular story, a love story, at this point in time?
You know, it seems like such an interesting time period. What I do is I create characters and I wind them up and I turn them loose and just see how they behave, what they bump into, what kind of circumstances they rub up against. And I knew I wanted to write a family story, a mother-son familial story, and really a story of abandonment and redemption. And there was so much going on at the time that it just made for a very confusing and conflicting landscape for my characters to dance around on. You know, I set the stage and then I turn them loose and I see what happens. But there were, you know, there's something about the issue of abandonment. I think everyone can relate to that in some degree, you know. And I think I, especially at a young age, where my character's, he's 12 years old, but that's the perfect age where you go from being this idyllic child to starting to have a mature awareness of emotional circumstance around you. I know from my own life, that was about the age when I first had my heart broken. So I relate well to that kind of experience.
When you think about the role of orphanages, especially during the Great Depression, and It's fascinating to think about their role and how ultimately that role has changed, and unfortunately how it has not changed. Was it always, in looking at abandonment, to be part of the story of a child and the story of an orphanage?
Yeah, the shocking thing about orphanages during the Depression, at least in Seattle, was that the majority of children there had living parents. And that was startling to me as a writer and a researcher. I mean, I think of the orphans, I think of Little Orphan Annie, and the thought of parents basically consigning their children to the care of others because they just couldn't care for them, and there weren't enough social conventions to give them support through, you know, a time of economic calamity. And sometimes the parents came back and got their kids, and sometimes they didn't or couldn't. And I was surprised to learn that the great author of the West, Wallace Stegner, he and his brother spent 9 months at the Sacred Heart Orphanage, the same place that's depicted in the book. And their mother dropped them off and later returned for them. But some kids weren't as lucky. Some kids were abandoned in public buildings like post offices, where the parents knew that a government employee would take that child to a receiving home and they would end up in some sort of custodial care.
I'm always curious as to how, I guess, things ultimately come about. And when you think of this particular orphanage, the Sacred Heart Orphanage that as you mentioned, featured in the book, Was it the history of the place that compelled you to stick with a real place and not create one?
I like using real places. It's interesting, and that's kind of a decision authors make, rather to use real locations or make them all up, because, you know, it's a novel, it's a work of fiction. I like anchoring my stories with real places. There's something about the spirit of the place that I think is important. And as a researcher, I could go to Sacred Heart, which is now the Villa Academy. It's a private school, and I could walk the grounds and see this sacred grotto and hear the sound my footsteps make on the wooden floors. And there's something very visceral about all of that. And I like putting that into the book. And if I disconnect that from the actual place, if I give it a fictitious name, it feels strange to me. But that's just, you know, that's just my habits as a writer. I like real places. I like grounding things in authenticity. The characters are made up, and so their stories, you know, they carry the fiction, but through a nonfiction world.
So is that what makes Seattle so special, is because you know it?
Yeah, you know, I think writers write about what they lament, and I haven't lived in Seattle for some time, and so I do miss the place, and so writing about real places keeps me connected to those places, if that makes sense. There's something about that longing or yearning and wanting to echo those places in my work that's personally very satisfying.
When you started to do, really to delve into the research, and you touched on this a moment ago about finding out this cinematic thread, was that part of the research, or did you know about that going in?
You know, the funny thing is I didn't know about the H.C. Weaver Studios. I knew Willow was going to have, she was going to come from a theater family and be an aspiring film star. And in the back of my mind, I was imagining having to jump the story to Los Angeles, just out of necessity. And I kept coming across these news articles of film crews working, you know, very early in the Seattle area. And I called the Seattle film office, and it's probably just, you know, the fault of an intern who answered the phone. But I asked them, what was the earliest film shot in Washington State? And they referred me to Tugboat Annie, which was shot in 1933. But I had all these news clippings of other movies being shot in the late teens. And so eventually I stumbled onto a photo collection at the Tacoma Public Library, which is the only visual record of this studio, which, you know, later in the 30s went out of business and burned down. But in its brief, tiny heyday, it was the third largest film studio in the country.
you talk about how Anna May Wong, the actress, was ultimately somewhat who you based Willow on.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, their stories differ, so it's not biographical. But I felt for Anna May Wong, and that's one of those characters. Even before this book, I mean, there are characters, you know, big Hollywood names that their stars shine really bright for a brief moment, and then later they're ostracized by their own communities. Whether that's Anna May Wong or Lincoln Perry, who most people know as Stepan Fetchit, or Sesue Hayakawa, who had a brilliant film career before World War II. There's an element of tragedy about these characters because they were such household names, and then they were shunned. And especially a character like Anna May, because she could never find lasting love, never married. She was too Chinese for a Caucasian love interest. There are miscegenation laws in the books that made it impossible for her to marry a Caucasian gentleman. And she courted, you know, she had dalliances with many, but she was too Western for a Chinese suitor. So she was really caught between both worlds, which is beautiful and tragic. And some of those emotions are echoed in Willow Frost.
And is it different for someone who is in that line of work, who is an actress versus an average person, if you will, who probably, obviously, is dealing with the same issues and challenges?
Yeah, I mean, it's different on a scale of opportunity. For someone of average means and average circumstances, their personal challenges take on a certain aspect. But for someone, the more famous they are, the more, you know, the farther they have to fall. We see that in Hollywood today, where, you know, most of the tragedies in Hollywood these days are seen and depicted off screen and in the tabloids.
The name of the novel is Songs of Willow Frost. It is published by Ballantine Books. Jamie Ford joins us on this week's book show. When you think about the story, and we go back to the very beginning of our conversation about exploring your history and exploring history in general, it is obviously worth noting that experiences of both your mother and grandmother help inform the story that you tell here.
Yeah, you know, I'm it's interesting, the family dynamic. I married an alpha female, and we have daughters, and we believe in raising alpha females. And my mom really was a matriarch of our family, and my Chinese grandmother the same way. But despite that strength and you know, intensity of character, they had a lot of personal tragedy and calamity in their lives. Whether that was you know, my mom, who in the 50s had four children, and one day her husband just, you know, went out for a carton of milk and never came back. You know, it's like a sad Bruce Springsteen song. And at a time when, you know, perhaps being a single mother, not only was there less support, but there were all kinds of, you know, there was a social stigma attached to those kind of women who found themselves in those situations. And my grandmother was the same way. My grandmother was a Chinese-American woman born in this country, got divorced in her very early 20s with a child, an unmarried mother with a child. In that time period, you know, there were unmarried women with children. Children were seen as, you know, there was some sort of defect, and there was judgments made on whether they were capable of raising a moral child if they weren't in this perfect Leave It to Beaver household.
The way that the novel shifts between the Great Depression and the 20s, was that a necessity or something that you wanted to do from the very beginning?
You know, that was really that was something I wanted to do from the beginning. Because it's such a beautiful contrast to go from the 20s, you know, a post-war, roaring 20s, women cutting their hair, kicking up their heels, to the Depression, where everything changed, where you really have a yin and a yang, an alpha and omega of economic circumstance, and it affected everybody. Regardless of social classes, of ethnicity, of geography, you know, it rippled through every corner of society. And it was such a huge swing. I mean, we've had little tastes of that kind of economic devastation, but nothing as long as and as lasting. And it was also interesting because that time period, you know, they had the same discussions about all the isms, the fear of the isms, you know, communism, fascism, socialism, isolationism. There was the same conversations that we've had in the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, really aren't that far different than what happened back then.
You note, there is an author's note at the end of the book, and you say, "My writing career began when I wrote my parents' eulogies." That's pretty incredible.
You know, it's true. I think, you know, as a younger writer, I had less to write about, and I think there's a reason that a lot of writers in their early 20s, they explore science fiction or fantasy or speculative fiction or literary fiction that is more about the prose and less about the story. Because I think I just wasn't kicked around by life enough, you know. And once I was older, and it was, I lost both my parents within about 18 months, also my grandfather, who I was really close to. That was when suddenly I had an emotional well to draw from, and suddenly my writing was much more potent. It was less about the prose, and it was more about banking and spending emotional currency on the page. And that was when I felt somewhat indulgent, because I was writing things that were really just for, you know, my own pleasure, my own joy of storytelling. And I was very, very relieved and delighted that other people cared about those stories too.
Did you ever feel lost in the sense of looking at wanting to write? And I think about this as you telling the story of delving into your family history, of basically wanting to color in that coloring book, but not knowing what crayons to use, and the people who would normally tell you are no longer there.
Yeah, very much so. You know, the coloring book analogy is very apt. You know, as a writer, it's like you're given a box of a million crayons, and you have to try out different colors. And I was at that time period where I wasn't sure what kind of writer I was or was supposed to be. And after my parents were gone, I was very curious as to, you know, that door was closed forever. There were a lot of questions that I had, and I was searching for answers, and I found those answers sometimes in research. And if I didn't find the answer, at least I found a emotional comfort or satisfaction in exploring those time periods. In retrospect, having a greater understanding of what my parents went through and a greater appreciation. And so, you know, going back to the coloring book analogy, you know, I started to fill in the blanks. I didn't have all of the answers, and I couldn't get those answers. So I colored them in, and the rest is history.
Also, without sounding like an armchair psychologist, I do have to
way
ask.
To go, Dr. Phil.
Because you talked about abandonment, and this part of your life, this part of your writing comes after the loss of your parents, and I lost both my parents in a very short period of time recently, and that's, I think that's, you know, a natural feeling of a feeling of abandonment, and would be something that you would explore.
Yeah, it's a family joke that if I ever created a line of fragrances, they would come in a cracked bottle and be called Abandonment. it's a way of embracing the melancholy and taking a perceived, perhaps a perceived weakness and turning it into a strength, to explore those things. I think we all go through the situation. We all lose parents, or we all lose somebody. We all have our hearts broken unless we've somehow, numbed ourselves to reality. I think we feel these things. And as a writer, it's worth exploring those feelings. I'm a big fan of writing about the human condition. I'm less interested in writing about car crashes and asteroid collisions and things like that. I like books as human stories about, records of the human condition. That's what fascinates me.
You used a term a moment ago about embracing melancholy, which I found fascinating, because in reading the book, and even in your last novel, even in Hotel in the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, while there certainly is a melancholy mood to them in many places, in most places throughout the novel, there you come out hopeful. There is hope and joy that exudes at the end.
Yeah, I like redemptive stories. Sometimes that's a literary way of saying happy endings. And I don't think I write books that end with rainbows and unicorns and
right.
and things like that. But I like the full range of emotion, and I tend to. I make this promise to readers: if I'm going to break your heart, I'm going to do my best to reassemble the pieces in better working condition. And I think that's a fair promise.
Is that ever a challenge? Is that ever hard to do, especially when you deal with history and reality?
Yeah, I mean it can be. With literary authors, I think there's a there's almost this trope, this cliche, to be taken seriously. You have to end on the most tragic scene possible. The groom gets hit by the bus on the way to the wedding. The end. Mm-hmm. And I'm never really satisfied with those kind of stories, so I don't want to do that. But I do want to, as I lay nails in the path of my protagonists and my characters, I do want to give them some moment of relief. I do want them to have some aspect of success or satisfaction. I think that translates to the reader, and I think that's what makes a really good story. I don't want to end on a perfect note, but I love endings like the movie Casablanca, where it ends on such a redemptive, yet there's an aspect of sadness to how it ends. And usually that's when a new story takes off, and that story takes off in the minds of readers or watchers. And I think that's what great storytelling is all about.
And it proves how much can be done with those nails that you give to those characters.
Yeah. I mean, one moment they're stepping on them, the next moment they're building something with them. It's all in how you set it up.
Jamie Ford's new novel is Songs of Willow Frost. It is published by Ballantine. Jamie Ford, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.